Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. Last month, Hurricane Florence walloped parts of North Carolina. According to the Weather Channel, it was the wettest tropical storm to ever hit the Tar Heel State. So how did the restaurant industry respond? Some helped FEMA weather the storm, while others got to work feeding people on the ground.
We just walked in and said, we know how to cook, what can we do? They said, I need you guys to just cook 150 pork loins, and we were just like, okay.
Now the attention needs to be on Florence's long-term effect on North Carolina's farming community.
The general mood of farmers is one of certainly resilience and almost feels like it's the normal course of business to just get hit by a gigantic hurricane and need to just keep on going.
So tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Cora Lee. A few weeks ago, I spoke with Mallory O'Donnell, a hobbyist slash professional urban forager based in New Jersey. We discussed the politics, shifting gender roles, and ethics of foraging, e.g. cutting versus pulling rant bulbs, the viability of weeds as universally accessible and affordable food, and the over and under policing of foragers, which varies depending on gender and color of skin. This week's guest, while not a self-proclaimed forager, certainly addresses many of these same issues that Mallory and I had discussed in her research. Natalie Doonan is a multimedia and performance artist, a writer and educator with a PhD in humanities, specializing in sensory studies, cultural geography, and performance studies, which we'll get into what all that means exactly. Her art and research specifically focus on the connections between taste and place, which is something we discuss on this show a lot. Thank you so much for joining me today, Natalie.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to open with the first line of this recent article that you put out in Gastronomica, which is, food is widely recognized as being integral to processes of identity formation and the mediation of boundaries between self and other, which I think I read it to be a really beautiful truism. What has food meant for you and your identity?
Yes, this is a really big question. So I guess I'll go back to my childhood and talking a little bit about my parents. My dad is a large animal veterinarian. And so before I even started going to school, I used to go to farms with him. And I think of that as kind of my, one of at least my very early influences in the realm of food studies, because it gave me the opportunity to get involved at a really young age with understanding where our food comes from, and especially thinking about animal welfare. So, for example, I used to be in charge of giving the calves what my dad called a milkshake, which is essentially an oversized human baby bottle, and getting involved in ways like that on the farm with him. And then on my mom's side, my mom was always a big gardener, and we had a huge garden in our backyard, and grew various things like watermelons and yellow beans and green beans and cucumbers and zucchinis. And I was the person who was in charge of harvesting all of that. So it gave me some understanding of the environment and what grows in particular environments, and how to harvest and prepare foods in a rudimentary way. And my parents also always took us to seasonal food harvesting practices. So, for example, every fall we would go apple picking, and in the summers we would do strawberry picking, blueberry picking, and things like that. So that would be really formative experiences in terms of my own identity with food. And then when I got older, around my early 20s, I started reading about corn. I got really interested in corn at the time, and I was reading about how cheap U.S. corn, genetically modified corn, was flooding the Mexican market and forcing farmers out of business and forcing Mexican farmers to migrate to other places like the United States looking for work. And reading about the Zapatistas and their involvement in anti-globalization and against NAFTA and things like that. And so that kind of introduced me and it opened up my eyes to this whole realm of labor around food and connected with the food choices that we make. And then speaking of Mexico, I ended up marrying a Mexican. I was at one point married to a Mexican and lived in Mexico for a couple of years. So I was part of a Mexican family, and I just remember certain experiences, like, for example, with avocados. My family there would laugh at me the way I would open up an avocado. You know, so they're really tangible experiences.
How would you open an avocado?
Well, so I would slice an avocado like around the middle and then open it in half and then, you know, make slices from the side that doesn't have the pit in it. Mm-hmm. And then kind of scoop it out like that. Whereas what they would do is like peel the avocado kind of like an orange.
Huh.
So, you know, just funny encounters like that in a really mundane way that where I came face to face with this idea of how food can mediate exchanges between self and other and make you really aware of your own identity and cultural differences, you know, mm-hmm. with things that you kind of take for granted. So all of those were really formative. And then when I moved to Montreal, I started a project called the Sensorium, which is a series of artist-led tours and tastings in and around the city. And I continue to work on that project a little bit, and I think of it as my way of getting to know the city with other people. So I invite people to lead tours a lot of the times, and well, just to give an example, there was one where two artists built like a mobile popsicle cart that was led by a bicycle, and they took us on a tour along the Lachine Canal here in Montreal, and they had made popsicles from local weeds, and so during the tour, they were handing out popsicles, and people were literally able to taste the neighborhood.
Mm.
And so through those experiences, I've been learning about the plants that grow where I live and coming to know this whole other dimension of food and harvesting.
Yeah. Have you heard of the artist? I forgot her name. It might be Julie something. She does smell maps, and it's of Newport, Rhode Island, where she grew up. And so it'd be like this area, and it'd be in rings of just strength of smell. And so like this area has juniper mixed with s'mores mixed with the local plants, and that very much reminded me of the popsicle cart.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, I did see, I think it was that map I saw a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, this would be another example of what I would maybe call sensory studies and why I'm interested in that. There's lots of different ways of approaching sensory studies. There are psychologists who work in sensory studies looking at how vision functions, for example. There are people in marketing who work in sensory studies trying to understand, you know, how do we best design a product so that it feels nice in a person's hand and it makes them want to buy it. That would be considered sensory studies as well, but the way that I look at it is more from an aesthetic perspective in terms of often everyday life. So when we walk around the city, how can we open our ears and our noses and our eyes and our skin to what's around us and learn about the places that we live in that way.
Yeah, I want to go back to one of the first things you brought up, which was growing up feeding your family's cows the milkshake. A few episodes ago, I spoke with this professor, Thomas Parker, who we talked about the history of eating animals and how the more we can place them into this subject-object relationship, the easier it is on us to eat them. And so when you are feeding the cow so intimately and feeding the cow a milkshake, which, you know, is something that we eat too, how did that complicate or, you know, strengthen your identity or that mediation or boundary between the cow and you? Or did you feel very similar to the cow?
Just to clarify, that wasn't on our farm. I never lived on a farm, but because my dad was a vet, I was able to go to work with him basically on other farms. So it wasn't something that I was living with, day and night. And it's interesting to me because I grew up eating meat and dairy products, and when I was a teenager, I had friends who were vegetarians, and really that was the first time that I started questioning, why I was eating that meat, you know. And then at a certain point, I became pescatarian. I never went completely vegetarian. I kept eating seafood. And it's something I continue to struggle with. I mean, food, these mediations that you're talking about are really, really complex. But at the same time, I don't think that by becoming, let's say, vegetarian, we are able to resolve the ethical issues around where our food comes from. I think basically anytime we eat a meal, we're making a compromise on some level, right? Mm-hmm. There's no perfect choice that we can make. So, I mean, even people who are vegetarians are eating like frogs and insects that have been ground up in the crops like wheat that they're eating, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it definitely does. I wasn't looking for a right or wrong, black and white answer. I think what you said is very true. So let's go back to sensory studies, cultural geography, and performance studies. Can you give a short elevator pitch on what any of those mean, and also where the idea of emplacement figures into all of this?
Oh, yeah, that's a really complex question. So, well, I already talked a little bit about sensory studies, and performance studies is the study of performances, which can range from anything from, your performance of eating breakfast in the morning, which could be kind of an anthropological study, I suppose, to the way that consumers purchase things in stores. Those are, performances as well, to performances that happen in a more spectacular kind of way on stage or circus or those kind of performances that are more directed at particular audiences. So people who do performance studies analyze the particular kind of performance that they're interested in as a cultural act. And then cultural geography, I think of cultural geography almost like a study that's in between geography and anthropology, because one thing that I'm really interested in my work is what the theorist and zoologist Donna Haraway calls nature cultures. So she treats that as a hyphenated word, which indicates that you can't separate nature from culture. They're very intertwined, and cultural geography takes that kind of approach to geography. So we're not just looking at physical landscapes and rocks, rock formations and that kind of thing, but we're looking at how humans interact with, and interact is not even the right word, but humans and their environments, they're intertwined, and they co-produce each other, I suppose you could say. And so that has to do with emplacement, because I suppose one way of explaining emplacement is that it's the idea of enacting a place being enacted. A place is not a stagnant feature or landscape. It's processual. It's part of complex human and natural processes that are ongoing and constantly evolving.
Mm-hmm. And so how you write about these cloudberries, and how do cloudberries emplace individuals living on Quebec's Lower North Shore?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I guess the first thing would be to talk about where the Lower North Shore is, because mm-hmm. even for people here in Quebec, where I live, most people have never heard of the Lower North Shore, or in French it would be called La Basse-Côte-Nord. If you say that to people, they think you're talking about the La Basque or La Côte Nord, which is not as far north. So the province of Quebec borders with the province of Newfoundland and Labrador to the east, and it's 400 kilometers of coastline along the St. Lawrence, and there are a series of 16 very small villages ranging in population from about 100 people to, I think the largest has a population of around 1,200 people. And the communities are very unique within the province of Quebec, which is majoritarily French-speaking. These communities are Anglophone primarily, and then there are some Francophone speaking communities, and then there are two Innu-speaking communities, which is the First Nation in this province. And just to clarify, because we're on American radio, when I say First Nations, I'm referring to Indigenous populations that were here before the arrival of Europeans mm-hmm. in what we now call Canada. So these communities traditionally have been fishing communities until the early 1990s, where there was a moratorium on cod fishing, which was the main fish that was caught. And that happened not because of the small fishermen, but because of industrial fishing in the region. But it had a huge impact on people in those communities which relied on fishing. So they had to start turning towards other economies. And so one of the things that they've been focusing on for the last, 10, 15 years now is wild berry industry. And so I guess maybe you'll be asking me some questions about that after, but you were asking about how people are emplaced there because of the berry picking. And what I'm really interested in that article that you mentioned from Gastronomica is the way that cloudberry picking can't be, or cloudberries can't be separated from the cultural practices that surround them. So you can't just look at the berry as a product or as a natural resource. You have to look at what people do with the berries and how they pick them, where they go to pick them. A lot of times what they do is they take boats to go out to islands to pick them. So then boating becomes part of the culture surrounding berry picking. And people go out with their families, from babies to elderly people. So it's a cross-generational activity, which is really interesting. And a lot of times, once they get out there, because the season is so short, it's maybe 2 weeks, they camp. They stay out there. They build fires. So cooking over open fires becomes part of it, and camping, and all of those things that are surrounding the actual berry itself, which I think is really important, because if you just treat the berry as a natural resource or an economic unit, then you can easily overlook all of the impacts. If you're thinking about domesticating the berry, for example, to start producing it on a bigger scale.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking about what you mentioned before, kind of blending your language of cultural geography and performance studies, and how our experience of, let's say we're talking about the LNS, the Lower North Shore, is processional. Do the cloudberries, or have they served as an effective substitute to the fish? Are the fishermen, have they justly re-identified as cloudberry pickers, or how has that changed the culture?
I think from what I've seen, it's a lot more complicated than that. And, when we're talking about the fishing culture, that was really, I mean, the communities were really built around fishing, right? So,
right.
I'm sure there were exceptions to that, but for the most part, people really identified with that fishing culture, and that was how they defined themselves. With berry picking, this is part of a process now of changing, and it's really mixed, right? And just to keep in mind, I'm an outsider kind of analyzing this, right? But I spoke with a lot of the people who live there, and what I heard from them was, you know, some people who are really on board with this economy, and even with the people who are on board, there are concerns, right? So, for example, people are really interested in picking wild berries. When you go there in August, when it's berry season, you don't even really have to ask questions because everybody's talking about cloudberry picking. That's the main wild berry that I was focusing on, or bake apples, as they call them on the Lower North Shore. And so it's important to everybody there, I would say, of all generations, but creating an economy out of it has certain implications. For example, a few years back in one of the communities, they tried to impose permits on locals and restrict the areas in which they could pick the berries. And so it wasn't very much that they were charging. I don't remember exactly, but it was somewhere around $10 for the season or something like that. But it really turned people off because the idea that they would have to go and pay for a permit to pick on their own land, the way they see it, is just not right, you know? And then there's the issue of sort of regularizing the work, right? Mm-hmm. So getting there's a co-op that has started up in the last few years there, and what people have been used to is a situation where outsiders, meaning people off the Lower North Shore and other places, are willing to pay for the berries and willing to pay quite a bit. When I spoke to them a few years ago, they were going for up to $12 a pound, and they would pay cash, right? It was sort of an under-the-table market. But if the idea is that all the locals are to sell their berries to the co-op in order to keep the economy local and create local jobs, well, this means that they can't sell their berries for as much money, and they have to declare it on their income taxes and things like that. So, you know, some people are opposed to those things because they're pretty radical changes. So there are all the issues around management, you know, management of the wild, that become kind of contentious issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I could talk more about that, but I don't want to go on and on. You have other questions.
No, we're going to get there. No, I just feel like it. It's easy to kind of treat it flippantly, right? Like it's kind of silly to impose a tax on what's quote unquote wild, or to regulate the wilderness. But on the other side, you know, there are people that are saying like maybe this $10 permit is allowing the cloudberry population to then serve many more generations. Do you think that's a valid claim?
Yeah, this is another issue that's hotly debated there. So in recent years, ATVs or all-terrain vehicles have become really big. Everybody on the coast owns an ATV, it seems. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are really frustrated because there's so much ATV use in the cloudberry bog. So cloudberries grow in bogs generally, mm-hmm. Or kind of marshy areas. And maybe we'll get into that later, but because of the way they grow, it's really labor intensive to go picking them. So it makes it a lot easier if you can just take your ATV out onto the bogs. But the problem is that destroys the plant.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've been told is that once you've crushed a plant, it won't regrow for 7 years.
Wow.
So that's a pretty big issue. And so one of the attempts has been to implement paths and have the paths monitored so that you can still ride your ATV, but you have to stay on the path so that you won't destroy the Cloudberry bogs.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the kind of ideas that are being floated around, but then there's opposition to those ideas too, because there are some who believe that that is impinging on freedom,
mm-hmm.
right? Certain freedoms that people have been used to over the years. There are questions around sustainability there, which also form part of the question of how we manage the wild, if we want to preserve the wild. And there has been talk also about domesticating the berry, and there's been a lot of research into domesticating cloudberries, which are very resistant to domestication, mm-hmm. and these scientific experiments have been ongoing since the 1950s. And one proposal is to grow, you know, you'd have kind of like cloudberry fields the way you have cranberry fields.
Mm.
And so it's the idea of intensely growing the berries in a smaller area so that they're easier to pick.
Mm.
But even that raises the question of whether they're still wild or now are they domesticated. But, you know, when you start comparing with other ideas that are being floated around, road building is another very contentious issue right now in that area, because there's no road connecting these 16 villages that I mentioned right now. And so some people on the coast want to build a road. Others are very against the idea because they're afraid of how their lifestyle will change with opening up the coast to a major highway and having a huge influx of tourists, for example, coming in.
Mm.
So all of that is part of it. And to go back to your initial question, it's not like there's not 100% buy-in, and it hasn't transformed into a community of commercial cloudberry pickers by any means.
Mm-hmm. So you seem, even this is just one instance, you seem super well-versed in the socio-political economic issues involved in the cloudberry case, but can you talk a bit more, let's zoom out a bit about your artistic body of work, your multimedia installations and performances, and how you address issues of all kinds? How do you choose your medium, and which issues have you chosen to address?
Mm-hmm. So one thing that I notice is that in the interdisciplinary field of food studies, there is nevertheless a lack of representation from the fine arts and humanities. So you see a lot of social science approaches and approaches basically from geography and anthropology. I see a lot of that. And while I do see a lot of artists who work in food or use food as subject matter, I really can't think of any that would situate their practices within the field of food studies. So I would like to see more representation within food studies by artists and people in the humanities. And in my own practice, what I think is important in the way that I choose the media that I use is what I call polyvocal storytelling, meaning that when you start to use other forms, not only writing, especially scholarly writing, then there are interesting technical ways in which you can tell complex stories. So you don't have to reduce the story to a linear narrative, for example, and have one voice succeeding the other, but you can maintain various voices, even contradictory perspectives at the same time. And just to give you an example of that that relates to this cloudberry work that we've been talking about, there's the article that you've been referencing in Gastronomica, but I also created an immersive artwork telling these same kind of stories from the Lower North Shore about cloudberry picking. And so what I had was a 16-foot dome that people could walk into, and it fits about 15 people at the same time, and you project on the surface of the dome. So there were projections that could be seen both inside and outside of the dome, and it was what I would call a storytelling project. I worked with two computer programmers who helped me create a voice recognition software. And the way that it worked is that you would come into the dome, and in the center of the dome, there's a small table with a button. And you press a button, and then you're prompted to repeat the Innu word for cloudberry. And if you say it correctly, then it will trigger a story to play. So it will trigger the next video, and then there's a average 90-second video that will play with somebody talking about something to do with cloudberries. And the videos are always triggered at random, so you never, even if you listened through all the video clips, you would never hear the same succession of stories. And this kind of strategy was really inspired by the cultural theorist Edward Said, who had a technique that he called contrapuntal reading, which is a way of taking into account intertwined histories and perspectives. He was looking mainly at ways of paying attention to the story of the colonizer and the colonized at the same time. And the Canadian composer Glenn Gould also had a similar method in his compositions that he called contrapuntal radio. So usually the term contrapuntal refers to music where an independent melody plays simultaneously, two independent melodies, play simultaneously. And so in Glenn Gould's recordings, he would interview people in various positions. Like, you might have an anthropologist and a nurse who both live and work in Canada's north, and he would be playing their voices, their stories at the same time. So the main idea behind that for me is that rather than trying to achieve some kind of democracy or agreement between various voices in a story, it's okay and it's actually favorable to try and maintain the antagonism between the voices, which is actually really productive so that we can understand the tensions in a certain issue, which there always are in food studies.
This is Meant to Be Eaten. I'm speaking with performance artist and educator, student of sensorialness, Natalie Dunin, and we'll continue speaking on contrapuntal, is that right?
Contrapuntal,
and the antagonistic view of the food studies world after the break.
Hearst Rant. Founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
And we're back. We were just speaking about the contrapuntal approach to learning about food studies. And so when I read your article on cloudberries, I kind of sat down and thought, what would be Brooklyn or New York City or even America's branded food? What is the one product that could symbolize us all, and I really don't think there is one. And it really changes depending on which community you ask. And I really also thought it was really interesting that Cloudberries was so easy for those communities to pick, because then if we were to use that same exact formula to Brooklyn, then it might be knotweed or mugwort, which grow incredibly rampantly here and are native and indigenous, but still many Brooklynites do not even know about either of these plants. So I just wanted to get your take. How do foods get branded for an area, and what do you think about our relationships to these foods?
I mean, what you're saying is, I think, true, because also we're looking at, on the Lower North Shore, a much smaller geographic area and communities that are made up of much smaller populations than in Brooklyn or other cities like Montreal. Mm-hmm. So, and also because the area has not been developed in the same way that Brooklyn or Montreal has, right? Mm-hmm. So you can have these large swaths of land where cloudberries and various other berries and Labrador tea and various trees are growing, right, that haven't been raised yet. And the cloudberry, because it only grows in certain geographic areas like boreal forests and subarctic tundra, it's just not available in most places, right? Which makes it a really unique food item. So it's maybe easier to brand a place around that specific food there because of those factors. Whereas once you start to look at a concrete place that has eradicated a lot of its berries and other plants, then it's harder to pick one particular plant or other foodstuff, right? Mm-hmm. So how that happens, I mean, it has to do with economic forces, right? And companies going in and deciding that they need a marketing campaign in order to sell a particular what they think of as product, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, it would be very difficult to do that, something like that in Brooklyn or in Montreal, I think, or other big cities.
So we keep referring to this one article. I'm just going to read the title. It's Wild Cuisine and Canadianness, Creeping Rootstocks and Subterranean Struggle. And so I just wanted to break that down word by word. And could you define, or why wild cuisine?
Yeah, wild cuisine, because I'm working on a project right now. It's a book project about wild food in Canada. And when you read the literature on Canadian cuisine, I mean, this is an ongoing debate in Canada, is trying to define what is our national cuisine. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to do that, right? Because of some of the things that you mentioned, and you talked about how cuisine in the U.S. is regional, right? Mm-hmm. And this is what a lot of authors say about Canadian cuisine as well, because it varies so much depending on where you are and what the landscape is like in that particular place, since we live in such a big country. But there are four characteristics of Canadian cuisine that come up again and again in the literature, and one of those is that it's wild. The others are that it's multicultural and it's local and it's seasonal, right? But in that article that you're talking about, I was interested in focusing on that one element of wildness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so with Mallory's episode, we talked about how trendy it is as people that live in cities to go and forage our own food because of said wildness. It's this weird spiritual fetishization of eating weeds and finding our own food. But how is that stereotype felt as a Canadian?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's really problematic. And that's not to say I think we should eradicate the word or anything like that. But I think I listened to that episode with Mallory, and one point that he made that I thought was really interesting is when he was talking about picking fruits mm-hmm. in cities, and he was talking about the case where you've got private fruiting trees that are hanging over a sidewalk or something like that, mm-hmm. and a lot of people will take those fruits and think, you know, it's fine. If they're falling on the road, then the people who own the tree don't care anyway. But he raised this issue of responsibility and said that in his view, it would be important to approach the owner of the property and ask them just to make sure it's okay. Mm-hmm. And the reason I thought that was really interesting is that we often don't think about the question of responsibility, and that's, for me, what's important in the idea of wild cuisine, okay? So, because if we really start to dig into that question of what makes a food wild, then we can't avoid thinking about the land, right? The land that it comes from, and that's what he's doing when he's saying, well, we have a responsibility to ask permission, right? Mm-hmm. And ask, whose land is it? So when we're talking about wild foods, the reason it's easier to see this as an issue on the Lower North Shore is because the population is so much smaller and you have Anglophone and Francophone populations literally living right next to, in one case, an Innu reserve and in another case, an Innu population, right? So they come face to face with each other, whereas in bigger cities like Montreal, we can easily ignore the fact that we're actually on unceded indigenous land, right? Mm-hmm. Here in Montreal, it's called Jojage. And it was traditionally meeting and trading grounds, and primarily of the Ganyangahaga Nation. But all across what we now call North America, it's Turtle Island, right? And so if we're talking about wild foods, I think, and your episode is called The Politics of Picking Weeds, so I think this is important here, is asking about whose land it is and what does it mean to be picking plants on this land. And it's a question that's relevant with other foods too, right? But in the case of wild foods, there's this whole narrative about the wild, which is part of a frontier ideology, which claims the land as empty. It's this Latin idea of terra nullius. And so when the British and the French came here, there's really this this underlying philosophy, which I always think of as coming from the British philosopher John Locke, where the idea is that the value of goods is based on their ability to generate income. Mm-hmm. So to have value, land has to be mixed with labor. And there's a really great book by the geographer Cole Harris, where he writes about how when the British came to, in this case, British Columbia, any garden that wasn't tended and arranged in the manner of the English was considered, and this is a quote, an inadequate measure of property. Mm. And so this term wilderness and the wild was used to encourage immigration by Western Europeans, you know, creating this idea that the land is empty and available. And I should say, just as a side note, that it was never true that First Nations people were leaving the land barren. The land was very much used, and agriculture was very much practiced. It's where we talk about the three sisters, right? Corn, beans, and squash. Mm-hmm. I think that when we talk about foraging and marketing foods as wild, there's a danger in perpetuating the same colonial mythology to conquer the land, right? Mm-hmm. So it's something important, I think, to keep in mind. Here in Quebec in particular, we have an ongoing debate about separation, which is important, you know, as in terms of preservation of French culture and heritage. But actually, it's largely ignored that, in fact, this land was stolen from First Nations by the French and the British. So the politics of picking weeds is very much a part of all of that.
Mm-hmm. I think this is actually a perfect question to leave you on. So is there such thing as wilderness management? Do you see a future for where this could be viable, or even is it useful at all?
Wilderness management?
Right.
Yeah, I think just to return to, I'll just stick with the same example of the Lower North Shore. I think that the efforts that are being made there are in a lot of ways really fantastic. You know, the idea of creating an economy that will support local people and that will provide alternatives to some of the other ideas, like, you know, creating a nuclear waste site as a way of generating income. It offers the possibility of creating a sustainable economy, right? Mm-hmm. And so in that case, wilderness management is actually, as ironic as it is, that's the whole point. The idea of wilderness in the wild is always ironic in our current day and age. Mm-hmm. But wilderness management is crucial in order to tackle some of the problems we talked about, including ATVs, for instance, or providing an alternative to building highways or further hydro development. So yes, it's something to be pursued. And you had another episode on terroir, which was really interesting because your guest talked about terroir as, I had the impression that he was really thinking about it as in terms of like the physical landscape producing the taste of place, whereas mm-hmm. another aspect of terroir has to do with the cultural practices that, the methods of planting and harvesting and so on mm-hmm. that imbue certain tastes to a product or ways of preparing that food. And I think that using the term terroir is maybe an interesting alternative to branding a product as wild. And that's something that those responsible for the co-op I mentioned on the Lower North Shore have been doing recently, is using this terminology of terroir, which I think has really interesting potential because it in itself as a term implicates those histories with the land that I was talking about before, and so all of that politics becomes easier to talk about.
Mm-hmm. I've been speaking with Natalie Dunin, multimedia and performance artist, writer, and educator with a PhD in humanities. I'm your host, Coralie, and this is Meant to Be Eaten. Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please, join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.